Environmentalists struggle to get the public to pay attention to seemingly abstract issues like carbon emissions, deforestation, and toxic chemicals, but people often take notice when the threat is to a particular animal. When Rachel Carson alerted the public to the dangers of DDT use, she focused largely on what it was doing to birds, even before images of oil-drenched birds became iconic symbols of the 1989 Exxon Valdez disaster. Since birds in particular seem to hold emotional value for many people, what would it mean if they started vanishing? In his latest book, Say Goodbye to the Cuckoo, Migratory Birds and the Impending Ecological Catastrophe, environmental writer Michael McCarthy traces their cultural meaning through the ages and looks into why their disappearance might have an impact on us in ways that are difficult to quantify. His book is published by Ivan RD, and I'm pleased to welcome Michael McCarthy to our show today. Hi.
Thank you.
And I guess right now we should be thinking about the migratory birds that went through the area that is the site of the largest oil spill ever.
Well, I spoke late yesterday to Greg Butcher, who is the National Director of Conservation for National Audubon, and he told me that luckily so far most of the oil hasn't come ashore. But if it were to come ashore, clearly there are enormous colonies of things like brown pelicans that could be absolutely devastating.
But the birds also eat the fish. Many of them eat fish, and the fish are definitely being affected by this.
Yes, that's true. I think that were the amount of oil that's actually come out, as you rightly say, this is probably one of the very largest oil spills in history, to reach the shore, I think we would see an environmental disaster on a scale we haven't witnessed before.
Did you have specialized knowledge of migratory birds before you began writing this book?
No, the thing that attracted me to the subject was the fact that we suddenly realized in the United Kingdom and in Europe that our migrants were declining. And as I looked into it, I realized that the migrants in Europe have the most enormous cultural resonance. There's half a dozen of them that are almost as part of European culture as cathedrals are.
But you say suddenly realized? Hasn't bird watching been something quite popular in Britain for a long, long time?
Bird watching is enormously popular in Britain, perhaps person per person more than it is in the United States or anywhere else. The Royal Society of Protection of Birds has 1 million members. But even though our birds are very, very closely monitored in the UK, it appears to have suddenly happened that the migrants have started to decline very sharply.
What percentage of the bird population are migrants?
Well, in the UK, about a third of our breeding birds are migrants.
The other two-thirds throughout the winter months?
Yes, they do. And there's actually a statistical relationship between how far you go north from the equator and what percentage of your birds will be migrants. And by the time you get to Spitsbergen, about 85% of them are migrants because the winter's too cold for them to stay around.
And are there certain flight paths that the migratory birds tend to fly in?
Yeah, sometimes they're the shortest distance between two points, such as the Straits of Gibraltar or over here between Yucatan and Louisiana. That's why there's a worry about that's where the oil is coming ashore.
Well, I've always wondered why, obviously there are evolutionary reasons, but why some birds, there's one I think that goes from the tip of South America pretty much to the Arctic Circle, why it would fly so far when all it would really have to do is probably fly from northern South America to southern North America.
Well, that's the Arctic Tern, and that is indeed a 10,000-mile flight, which is one of the wonders of the natural world.
And it's a small bird.
It's pretty small. You could fit it in a briefcase, certainly. But even smaller, for example, if you take the barn swallow is half the size of a TV remote control, and that flies from South Africa to northern Scotland every year. So that's quite a feat, I would have thought.
Has anybody figured out why?
Yeah, we sort of know why. Well, migration happens because of one of the premier consequences of the Earth's orbit around the sun, which is seasonality. There are great differences in food resources and in conditions in different parts of the world in different seasons, and it may pay you to make the effort to move between them.
Does every part of the world have a certain percentage of migratory birds?
Well, on the equator, birds tend to be resident. The closer you get to the equator, the more resident they are, because conditions and food resources tend to be unvarying all the way around. But as I said, the further north you go, the more, and the further south you go, the more the larger the percentage of your birds is migratory.
Now, a major concern of yours in this book is something that's called bioculture.
Well,
what's
this
that?
Is just beginning, yeah, to look at the meanings birds have for us, not just the pleasure we take in their colours and their wonderful activity, but also they mean to us more profoundly in terms of culture. And the migrants in particular, when they come back, if you think about it, they're signalling the greatest change of the year. Their arrival is a signal of spring, a wonderful signal of spring.
And Europeans have been noticing this for a long time. Aristotle noted that birds migrated, didn't
he? Well, Aristotle was the first person to write about migration, as he was indeed the first person to write about so many things, from logic to literary criticism. But in fact, Aristotle got wrong what he wrote about migration, because Aristotle took too many old wives' tales and didn't take them with the requisite pinch of salt. Aristotle thought that migratory birds hibernated. And there's only one migratory bird that's ever been found to hibernate, which is in fact an American bird, a common poorwill.
So he thought they just went off into a cave or something, the way bears
Absolutely.
Go off to caves.
Absolutely, yeah. And that thought bedeviled the study of migration for 2,000 years.
So when do people start becoming aware of the migration? For example, Europeans went into Africa and colonized it centuries ago. Did they notice that the same birds that they had during the summer were in Africa during the winter?
Well, they did, but that wasn't really until the late decades of the 19th century. There was actually a particular moment when it was first realized that European birds went to Central Africa, and that was in 1822 when a German nobleman shot a white stork near his castle near the Baltic Sea, and this was found to have an arrow in its neck. And this arrow, it was eventually realized, the provenance of it was from Central Africa. So this stork had flown all the way from Central Africa back to Mecklenburg in northern Germany with an arrow in its neck, only to be shot by the nobleman, alas.
Mm-hmm. And so a light bulb went off, they didn't have light bulbs in those days.
German ornithologists would now claim that this was the case. And the arrow stork, or the Pfeilstork, as it's called, is kept in the zoology departments of Rostock University, and it's regarded as a paradigm shift in the study of migration, but in truth it was actually forgotten. And it was not until really the advent of bird banding in the 1890s that we really started to understand where birds went in the winter.
What was John Masefield's swallow? And
John, yes.
Why do you write about it as representing the most dramatic milestone in all of our understanding of bird migration?
John Masefield was a middle-class provincial attorney in a Midland town in England. And when bird banding came in, he was in his 70s. But he decided to put ringing, we call it. He decided to put rings around the swallows that nested in his porch. And he put a swallow around one in May 1911 with the number, the ring B830. And 18 months later, the magazine British Birds got a letter from a hotel proprietor in South Africa saying a farmer up the road has just found this swallow with this ring on with an address in London. What do you think about that? And that was the first indication that swallows migrated all the way from Britain, all across Africa, across the Sahara Desert to South Africa.
But to really prove it, that bird would then have to come back to England.
Well, you could logically argue that, but I think that if it had bred the year before, the logical implication would that it would return.
My guess is Michael McCarthy, whose latest book is Say Goodbye to the Cuckoo, Migratory Birds and the Impending Ecological Disaster. It's published by Ivan Ardiz. And then there's Reg Moreau.
Well, Reg Moreau was a man almost nobody's heard of in the United Kingdom, let alone the United States, but he was really the first man who pulled together the whole science of migration. And in 1972, he published the first real synthesis of what all the birds in Europe did and where they went in the winter.
I'd assume that the internet has made the whole process a lot easier.
In what way?
Well, because people can instantaneously respond. People can report from all over the world. It doesn't. There was a time, when British newspapers would get people would mail in that they just spotted a migratory bird, and the papers would publish it. That doesn't happen anymore.
What you're referring to is a specific institution we used to have was that the Times, of which you've just been speaking, People used to write to the Times and say they'd heard the first cuckoo. Mm-hmm. And that is, the Times hasn't actually published a first cuckoo letter since 1940, but for 100 years before that, it published first cuckoo letters every spring.
And why do certain birds like cuckoos, nightingales, for example, Keats writes an ode to a nightingale, why do they capture the imaginations of artists?
Well, because for a number of reasons. One is the nightingale is the bird that sings in the dark. Now, you have mockingbirds that sometimes sing in the dark, but the nightingale sings entirely in the dark, and it's a very strong song, and it's a very beautiful song. And when you hear it, normally you have to go out of your way. You have to be in the middle of a wood at midnight. And it, as it were, it performs a duet with silence, and its song is absolutely heart-stopping. Whereas the cuckoo is different again. The reason the cuckoo we find so moving is it is the most musical sound in all creation. It is the cuckoo's two-note call. It is a perfect interval. It's a descending minor third.
And it winds up being put on clocks.
Well, actually, the reason that cuckoo clocks irritate people is that the cuckoo call on a cuckoo clock is actually a major third, just to be technical. And that irritates the hell out of people, whereas the minor third of the cuckoo in real life is a bit more plaintive.
Now, you say about the nightingale, the bird has been eclipsed by its own cultural profile.
Yes, this seems to me a peculiar fate for a bird such as the nightingale to undergo. If you remember the song A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square, which most people know, written by Eric Maschwitz, who also wrote These Foolish Things Remind Me of You. When people think of the nightingale now, they just think this is the bird that sang in Berkeley Square. And, of course, the nightingale is not an urban bird. No nightingale ever sang in Berkeley Square. So one of the things I did in this book was, as it were, to try and un-Berkeley Square the nightingale. So I went out into the woods with my 11-year-old son in the dead of night to listen to them.
Why are migratory birds particularly vulnerable to environmental threats? I would have thought that birds that that stay would be just as vulnerable.
Well, they are, that's true. But migratory birds have multiple threats to them. If you think about it, they can be threatened at home where they nest. Then they can be threatened on their journeys to their wintering grounds, and it's worth bearing in mind that it is estimated that 1 billion birds are shot around the coast of the Mediterranean every year. And then they can be threatened also by degradation on their wintering grounds, and we've seen just devastating deforestation in South America, and also it's happening now in Africa.
So this is just a recent phenomenon? We didn't have any problems with migratory birds until the last few decades?
American ornithologists were the first people to sound the tocsin about this and to ring the alarm bell. And 20 years ago, American ornithologists really began to fear for American migrants, principally because of the rate at which deforestation was taking place in South America. The concern about European migrants, which go to Africa, is much more recent, and that's in the last 4 or 5 years.
And are some of these species facing extinction?
Well, they may be facing local extinctions. The two birds that have gone extinct in Britain since the Second World War were both sub-Saharan migrants. So who knows? That may have been one of the reasons why they disappeared.
You say toward the end of the book that it would be virtually impossible to take conservation action to cope with all of these environmental challenges affecting the birds. So I'm not sure that this book is a call to action rather than just simply a lament.
I think it is a lament. I think it's also an attempt to make people realize what's at stake and what may be lost. And what may be lost is not just species. What may be lost also is meaning. I mean, if you think of what the migratory birds symbolize when they come, they symbolize the change from the cold times to the warm times, which is wonderful and exhilarating. But they also signal the profoundest change of all, which is a change from death to rebirth. They symbolize, if you like, Earth's great cycle, the fact that all life ends, but new life comes as well.
The stork is supposed to bring babies.
Well, that's
a migratory bird, isn't it?
The stork is indeed a migratory bird, and it's venerated. It does. We unfortunately don't have it in the United Kingdom, but all across Europe it is venerated for its as a bringer, not only of the spring, but also as a bringer of good luck, and as you rightly say, of fertility.
Interestingly, this book could be quite funny in parts. I mean, this is such a sad story, and yet you found humor in it.
Well, you know, there's humor in life, isn't there? We've laughed a couple of times here talking about this. I mean, there's a few things. I mean, for example, the story of James Bond, the story of how Ian Fleming got the name for the sexiest secret agent in the world was from a gentleman ornithologist of the Philadelphia Academy of Sciences who wrote the first book on South American birds, really, Birds of the West Indies, which he wrote in 1936. And when Ian Fleming, the Bond author, was writing the Bond novels, he was looking for a name, and it was because he was a keen birder, a copy of Birds of the West Indies was on his shelf, and he stole the name from there.
And, of course, in England, slang for young women is birds.
Well, it used to be. I used to say...
That's over?
I used to say it 25 years ago, although even then I think I was probably pretty politically incorrect in doing so. But we don't say it anymore.
Meanwhile, we have... we've done a Please Explain. We have a series on our show called Please Explain. And we did one on bird songs. And listeners can find a link to that on our show page at WNYC.org. And Michael McCarthy will be giving a talk tonight at 6 o'clock at the Central Park Arsenal. That's at 64th Street and 5th Avenue. Tomorrow he will be reading he will be leading a spring migration bird walk from 8 to 9:30 a.m. It leaves from Central Park West and 72nd Street, but it's limited to 20 people. If you want more information about that, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. His book, Say Goodbye to the Cuckoo, Migratory Birds and the Impending Ecological Catastrophe, it is published by Ivan R.D. And I want to thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much indeed.